All right, Proverbs, shall we? Here's another good one on planning and just how you think through your life. This is one that is pertinent in my life for sure. Proverbs 16, 1 through 3. Let's look at that one. Somebody read that as you get there.
The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answers of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established.
All right. So a lot of this is the concept of, man, how do you know the will of God? Where are we supposed to be going in life? What do you do? How do you make plans and yet rest in the fact that God's in control and he's going to direct paths ultimately? Man, I remember sitting in the KT guest house in Bangkok, Thailand in 1997 on a mission trip and thinking about, Lord, what the heck are you doing with my life? Like, I'm a college student. I got a year left or so or college and think I like ministry and want to go that direction, but I'm not sure. So you're efforting and you're doing these things to, you know, put your life in order and hopefully head in some direction, but you're not entirely sure where God's going to direct you. And my life has really been guided by that principle of, look, Lord, I'm going to work hard and effort and try to do what I can do. And then ultimately you're going to open the doors or close the doors and guide me where I need to go. You know, in 1997, I was sitting across the table from Brad Bell and we had been friends for a long time and talked about, man, one day, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, when I came and planted a church in Fresno, if you came with me, we did ministry together. I thought, boy, that sounds awesome. So that was my life's plan, and everything that I did revolved around that idea of, Lord, I think you're heading in that direction. I think that's where you're taking me, but I need to bloom kind of where I'm planted in the moment. And sure enough, graduated from seminary, thought I had a job at Northwest Bible, actually, where Brad was the college director, and then their senior pastor died, and they hired me, and then they unhired me, which was odd. So got a call from Brad saying, oh, by the way, you're not hired anymore, so you're, you know, 6 months before I graduated from seminary, they said, you don't have a job anymore. I said, okay. So I took another job at a church in Dallas that I absolutely loved called Watermark. Worked there for a year and a half. It was fantastic. And then they do what the well does all the time. And they blew up the entire church and said, let's start over. We don't like how we're doing things. So let's put all the Lego pieces back together on the table and figure out how we want to reorg and restructure our church to better minister to our people. And in that process, my job went away and another guy's job went away. Like, okay, this was awesome. So like every staff meeting at the well, we have that moment of like, what are we going to do today? Do I still have a job? So it's fun because it keeps people on their toes. So today I was doing this. Tomorrow I may be, you know, the toilet cleaner, and that works well. So whatever. So this other guy found a home in the midst of another spot in the ministry. He did men's ministry or marriage ministry. And I was like, I liked what I was doing. So I don't know. And they said, great, we'll pay you for 6 months and you go find another job. And if you find another job before then great. And it was a phenomenal parting of ways, but I had no idea that that was coming and loved the church and God opened up another door in a small town north of where I grew up in this little farming community and just south of the Oklahoma border. Went out there and it was the worst beating of my life. It was 9 months of like, it was horrible. And it was horrible for me. It was horrible for the guy that I worked with. God had to work out a lot of things in me. I was wrestling with some immaturity and was not a great team member at the time. And the church was jacked up from a lot of different angles. And it was a great testing period for me for a lot of reasons, but it was awful. But that was not in my plans. That was not what I thought I was going to do. So it was like, Lord, well, okay, here we are. And now we've been through just a desert season. We went from a time of plenty. Now we're in a time of need and want. And then God, long story short, opened up the door for the third time for us to come work at the well. And we came out here in 2004 and worked out here for a long time and loved the well, obviously, and still currently work here. But in 2009, felt like God was calling me to do something else in conjunction with this that, man, I never saw coming. And all of a sudden, now here I am 4.5 years and to launching a nonprofit and, you know, have zero expertise or knowledge or experience or degrees or anything that would say that I should be doing what I'm doing today. But here I am, right? And my whole life has kind of been that way. It's like, Lord, I think I'm headed in that direction, but I need to kind of write my plans in pencil and hope that this is what you want, and if it's not, then we can erase it quickly, and I'll go where you want to go. So as you guys think through your life and where you're headed, make sure you kind of guide your paths that way. That's how God works. He doesn't tend to move parked cars. So Go in a direction that you feel like God is taking you based on your gifting and your passions and your desires, and put your sail up in the wind and let God guide it, okay? Don't sit there and panic and don't move and be stuck in a position. Let God direct your sails, if you will, and he'll take you where he wants. Most people, when they look in the rearview mirror 10 years in hindsight, they would have never guessed where God had brought them 10 years from that point. They would have never said, oh yeah, I saw all that coming. It was clearly laid out. This was my plan. This is exactly where I thought I'd be. Very few people, their lives are like that, okay? So if that's the case, and God truly directs, and he honors the plans that we have, it doesn't mean that we don't make plans. We should, and we should definitely have an idea of, Lord, this is where I'm going. And we hold that again with an open hand. But God knows where you're at, right? He has you where you are for a reason. One of the things that I think younger people struggle with, maybe more so than folks that are maybe more established in their careers, is always thinking about what's next and not being in the season that they're in. It happens with singles. It happens with young folks in jobs that maybe aren't going to be, gosh, I hope I'm doing this for 40 more years, right? So bloom where you're planted. Allow God to use you exactly where you are, even if you know that that's not the final destination on the map. Be there and be all there. And until God releases you from that or moves you on, be present, okay? Be present as a single, right? Enjoy that season. It is a phenomenal season. Let God use you in a way that he can't use you as a married person, okay? Whatever stage of life or area of life it is, be all there. And continue to move and know that ultimately it's God that's going to be the one that directs your paths, okay? Be encouraged in that and know that that's the case for most of us, that you're not going to know exactly where it's going to be, and that's how God works. At the end of the day, if your heart is, Lord, I'm about doing your work, regardless of stage of life or job title or whatever, and if that's your heart, God will direct your paths and use that to his great advantage, if you will. So, keep that in mind as you guys are planning. Encourage you guys, again, to have those and think through where you want to be and what you want to do. Hold those with an open hand, but let your heart be completely submitted to him in whatever he chooses, and guide those paths wherever whatever he wishes. All right? So commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established. Thoughts before we move on.
How were your conversations with your wife?
Crazy. At each stage, or the most recent, or...
Yeah, at each stage, or, yeah, maybe the most recent, because that's kind of been...
Yeah.
That's a big change, you know.
It was. Fortunately, I married up. Pete, as I imagine you did as well. So someone got the bad end of that deal, so sorry, wives. I would not be where I'm at today without her, to be frank. She was amazingly supportive and trusting and encouraging through the process. Knowing that, you know, we were going to quit a full-time role at the Well that, I mean, we enjoyed, you know, 98% of my job I loved, which, you know, for most jobs, if you get 80%, that's good. So, knowing that we were going to quit, go live on support, raise money, start a nonprofit in the worst economical times that we've seen, at least in my life, right? And she was completely supportive. So I could not have done that without her. So thankfully I married a woman that was not risk averse, but yet was wise. So she was the first person I went to in the midst of that, and we sat on a lot of that for about 3 months before we even really went public with it or told folks that we feel like this is where God's leading us. So the bigger the decision for me, the longer we took to make sure that, man, I didn't have some crazy wild hair idea, right? I've got like 10 books that I haven't written yet that yesterday I really wanted to write it, and today I'm like, that was dumb. And that happens to me all the time. That's a great idea. That's a horrible idea 24 hours later. So I wanted to make sure this one was still a good idea tomorrow. So yeah, that was key for sure. For sure, for sure. If you haven't been there, you will, okay? Then those forks in the road are hard, and sometimes they come quickly. Sometimes they come without desire, right? You know, you never know when God's going to bring those. But just remain faithful, keep moving, and most importantly, bloom where you're planted. Be excellent where God has you, right? I think of even some of you guys in the room with job changes and situations specifically at the Well. It's because of your faithfulness and your current occupation, that your current job description, that when positioned opened up, it was like, absolutely, that person's been doing it already, they've been doing a great job, and now doors open for them to do new things or different things or go plant churches or whatever it may be. So keep doing what you're doing. All right, So, Deuteronomy, shall we? Actually, Numbers. Let's finish that first, since you guys wouldn't let me finish it last Friday. It's all your fault. 32. As you go there, let me pray for us, and we'll jump back in. God, I'm very grateful for the rain today, for a new day, and for your blessings on this land. God, I think of the words that you communicated to the Israelites many, many years ago as they walked into a land that was not theirs, as they enjoyed crops that they didn't plant, and enjoyed the bounty of a fruitful harvest that they had nothing to do with. And God, you promised them that you would bring the early and the late rains, that you would care for their land and for them. And God, as we remember our land that is desperately in need of rain, we pray to the God of all that can do everything, that you continue to bring rain to our land, that you would replenish us in this time of drought, that we desperately need water. So, Father, in the areas that we so quickly come to realize that we are out of control, that we have no, we just cannot change the reality of those things, we lean to a God that can. So, Father, thank you for your goodness and your graciousness to us this morning, to our land, and to us, even as we sit here and study. Would you give us insight? Would you give us, Lord, just a heart to learn and eyes to see, God, what you see? And teach us this morning, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So, we have seen in Numbers now the new generation has risen up, right? They're heading into the promised land. Shortly in the book of Joshua, we'll begin to see those conquests. In chapter 32 now, at the end of their initial battles outside the land, we've defeated Sihon and Og and these kings that are ruling in areas on the east side of the Jordan. There's going to be now a group of tribes in chapter 32 that come to Moses and say, hey, we want to stay here. We don't want to cross over to the Jordan. We want to set up shop on the east side. And Moses is going to have quite the stern rebuke for them, if you will. But we'll see kind of how this goes, okay? So chapter 32, Reuben, Gad, in 32:1, and we find out later, half of the tribe of Manasseh. Okay, so Reuben, Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh come to him and say, listen, we're wanting to settle over here. This is their request. Verse 5, pick up there, and this is what they ask of him. 32:5.
And they said, if we have found favor in your sight, let this land be given to your servants for a possession. Do not take us across the Jordan.
All right, so this is their request, okay? So they're big tribes, and they want to stay on that side of the Jordan. Moses has an initial response to this that is interesting. Look at verse 6. Keep going.
But Moses said to the people of Gad and to the people of Reuben, shall your brothers go to war while you sit here? Why will you discourage the hearts of the people of Israel from going over into the land that the Lord has given them? Your father did this when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land.
So how does Moses respond to this? What does he mean by, this is what your fathers did at Kadesh Barnea when they went to see the land? Yeah, this is a lack of trust. This is a, you're going to see the land, and it's a great land, and you come back with a bad report. So Moses sees this as very negative, saying, listen, you're trying to discourage the people to not go into the land that God had promised them. This is not okay. And he rails on them from 9 and following, and calls them some nasty things. So verse 14, now behold, you have risen up in your father's place, a brood of sinful men, to add still more to the burning anger of the Lord against Israel. I mean, Moses is mad. Like, he sees this as an act of defiance, unfaithfulness. You don't believe, and you're just that bitter root of wormwood that's going to now rise up in the people because you don't want to do what God's called you to do, okay? And they're kind of backing up and going, whoa, 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 this is not at all what we meant, right? That wasn't our intent, but that was Moses' initial response, okay? Verse 16, this is their rebuttal to Moses. Look at that.
Then they came near to him and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our little ones. So we will take up arms ready to go before the people of Israel until we have brought them to their place. And our little ones shall live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return to our homes until each of the people of Israel has gained his inheritance.
All right, so what are they saying? What's their response?
We'll fight.
Yeah. We want the land, but we're going to fight. So we're not trying to discourage anybody. And in fact, we're going to set up shop. We'll leave the women and the children here, and then when we're ready to cross the Jordan, we're in, and we will fight alongside of our brothers. We will not return to our homes until, verse 18, every one of the sons of Israel has possessed their inheritance. So they're saying, no, Moses, we're all in, okay? For we will not have an inheritance, verse 19, with them on the other side of the Jordan and beyond, because our inheritance has fallen to us on this side of the Jordan toward the east. So we are one and the same, and we're going to set up shop together. Okay, Moses' response, here it is in verse 20. Keep going there.
So Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will take up arms to go before the Lord for the war, and every armed man of you will pass over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven out his enemies from before him, and the land is subdued before the Lord, then after that you shall return and be free of obligation to the Lord and to Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord.
All right, so what does Moses say? Green light, okay? Now, how did he initially respond? Not so much, right? He was angry, okay? Great leadership lesson, right? Moses starts off like he hears something and he immediately goes for the jugular and says, how dare you? Now, some of that's based on 40 years of being in the desert with these people that have worn him out, and he's seeing the same potential root issues in the people that lack faith, and he thinks he sees them here, but he allows them to speak. As a good leader, he actually listens and says, oh, I was wrong. Okay, that's not at all what you intended. So you're saying you just want to set up shop here because you got a huge flock of sheep and goats and whatever, and you're willing to go fight with us, and you're committed to fight until we're done fighting, and then you're going to go back home. Is that what I'm hearing? And they said, yeah. And he said, oh, okay, that makes sense. So good leadership lesson on Moses' part for all of us as well. His initial gut reaction was completely wrong. And he heard the people and went, my bad. Okay, if you'll do this, then absolutely. Now, he still has a bit of reservation. Verse 23, if you do not do so, behold, you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you. Meaning, like, great, however, I'm committing you guys to go fight. And if you don't fight, that's sin, and God's going to deal with your sin, is basically what he's saying. I'll never forget this. It drives me crazy. There's a guy in Denton, the town that Shay and I and Jared spent a lot of time in college, as did Brad, where we kind of went through our residency program, that has a bumper sticker that says Numbers 32:23, and it says, be sure your sin will find you. And I'm like, man, that's a great evangelism tool to the non-Christian. I'm sure that's exactly what they want to see, right? But, and completely out of context anyway. So, but the idea is they've given their word, and if they back out on their word, God says, or Moses says, God's going to deal with you, okay? So 24 and following, he says, great, green light, build your cities up, your sheepfolds, and do what you have promised, okay? 25, the sons of Gad, sons of Reuben, said to Moses, your servants will do just as you commanded. Our little ones, our wives, our livestock, and our cattle shall remain there in the cities of Gilead. While your servants, everyone who is armed for war, will cross over in the presence of the Lord, and we're going to go to battle. Okay, so they get the green light to stay. Okay, so note to self, this will be important later. Verse 33, Moses gave to them, to the sons of Gad, to the sons of Reuben, and to the half tribe of Joseph's sons, Manasseh, that land. Okay, so they get the land. Sihon, Og of the Amorites, the Bashan, the land of the cities of their territories, and the cities surrounding the land. Okay, so there are 2.5 tribes that settled Transjordan. Okay, the east side of the Jordan is known as Transjordan. Okay, so Reuben, Gad, half tribe of Manasseh. Okay, drill that into your head. You're going to want to know that. Okay, so they're going to settle there. The other half of Manasseh is going to settle on the west side. So they're kind of divided, okay? Long term, we're going to see this in the book of Judges as actually being a problem, okay? You see natural land divides. What happens when you have natural divides geographically with people groups? What begins to occur? Absolutely, right? So language changes, culture changes, traditions change. We're going to find out that in the book of Judges, when everyone's kind of doing their own thing and you lose influence from the greater whole, this pocket of people on the east side of the Jordan are going to behave and act differently. So much so that even their dialect changes, their accent and so forth, and we're going to see that ultimately it's going to become a snare. It didn't have to be, but it's going to be an issue later. So it's an uphill battle, if you will, that they fight well at the beginning, but turns into a problem.
So does that go along with, like, you talked about
when we were talking about the story of Eden, how East was like representative of sin.
Yeah. I don't think so here. I think their hearts are right. That's a great observation. But I think they're okay here. So this was not originally per se part of the land that God had promised them. They asked for it, and God says, "Okay, I told you you couldn't have Moab or Edom, but this stuff you can have." Okay, so He gives it to them.
Was it half of the tribe of Manasseh, or are they saying that Manasseh is a half tribe? Because I always thought they were a half tribe with the other.
Full tribe, half of the tribe stays east side, and the other half is on the west side. So no, they're not a half tribe. They're a full tribe. Yeah, so just half of them, because they're so big. And again, that's from Joseph, right, because of the blessing. Stay over there, okay? So, make sense? Cool. So, we'll continue that later. So remember, as they go into the land, Moses is going to tap them on the shoulder and say, "Y'all coming?" And if they don't respond, they're going to get the whooping stick. So we'll see how that goes, okay? 33, this is the chapter that we had just briefly mentioned. This is a review of the entire Exodus journey from Exodus chapter 12 as they leave in the 40 years that they're in the wilderness. This is every stop that's recorded for us, okay? Again, 41 places where they set up camp in 40 years, okay? So if you want to get an idea of about how often the Israelites set up camp and had to move, okay, it's about once a year, okay? So that's the idea, okay? We won't read through all this, but you guys can see where they camp. We've read through a lot of this stuff, but now Moses is faithful to write it all down and to make mention of it for us, okay? So, cool.
Do you think Moses was writing his first five books, like, in the desert, or, like, right at the end of his life?
Yeah, it looks like he wrote most of it probably at the foot of Mount Sinai. So as they were 40 days and 40 nights up the hill, possibly then. And then obviously he had a lot of time in the 40 years to write. So some of the stuff obviously occurred later. You know, we're going to see the death of Moses recorded. So it's like, how did that happen? Right. So maybe Joshua. So there were parts obviously that aren't attributed to him. But yeah, he had plenty of alone time with sheep and frustrating people. So he probably needed his alone time. Okay. So. Look at verse 50 of chapter 33. This is kind of after the camps have been laid out. This is the one of the first commands of God. We're going to see this repeated over and over and over again of what they're to do when they get into the land. Okay, look at verse 51 or even 50. Lord, Moses spoke at the plains of Moab, so just opposite. They're by Jericho, just on the east side of the Jordan, and they're going to be here for a little bit. Look at 51 and following.
Metal images and demolish all their high places, and you shall take possessions of the land and settle in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it.
All right, so what's the commandment in 52? How much are they to destroy? All, repeated four times in one verse, okay? All the inhabitants of the land, all their figured stones. What are figured stones, by the way? What does that mean? Idols, okay, absolutely. All their molten images, what are those? More idols, okay, different kind of idols, upgrade idols, okay, in all their high places. What are high places? It's where you put the figured stones and the molten images, and you worship them, okay? So he's saying, what is God focused on here? Idolatry. You are to do, what is the most important thing about going into the land? Get rid of all the false worship, okay? Anything that they worshiped that was not God, destroy all of it. Their images, their carved stones, their stuff they made out of gold or silver or whatever, destroy it all and destroy the places where they do it as well, okay? And how much of it do they have to destroy? All, okay? God is going to be like relentless in helping them understand. I don't mean 98%. I mean all. And the problem that Israel has going into the land is they do a lot. They just don't do all, okay? And this is one of those things where it's like, listen, 100% or zero. Okay, anything less than 100 is the same as zero. It does not matter. He wants complete and total obedience, okay, or it's just not going to work, okay? And the reason is, and we'll see this later, or actually we'll see it now to a degree, 55, if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then they shall become about those whom you are, remain will become as pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land which you shall live. Okay, the bigger picture behind them being what 55 kind of paints as a nuisance is they're going to woo you in to their systems of worship. They're going to sound like a great partner to begin with because they're going to be scared and running, and you're going to have the upper hand, and you're going to want to make them as slaves to you or to do what you want. That's not ultimately what's going to work. They're going to entice you to worship their gods and all of the stuff that they believe, and that's not going to fly. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, so God says destroy them all. Okay, 34 is the division of the land. Okay, and the boundaries of the land. For our purposes, the boundaries of the land that Israel currently has is, maybe less than half of what God originally allotted. Okay, so as you think through the promised land and the scope of it, the southern border goes all the way down into the Gaza Strip, which is in really to like further down south of that. Okay, so southern-wise, way, way, way down south into Egypt. Okay, northern-wise, it goes up into Lebanon. Okay, so if you take the current promised land and the length of it up to where now the border of Lebanon is, if you doubled that northwise, they have that much more land up north that God wanted to give them. And to this day, they still haven't possessed it. So they have a ton of land that they still currently don't occupy. Okay, so it's crazy. And we'll see that even mentioned more so in the book of Deuteronomy with the actual dimensions of the land.
So they didn't have it at this time either?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
They conquer a lot of it. But they have never, I shouldn't say never. They have occupied portions of it in the king's time. When Solomon reigns, they're going to own a bunch of it. But they have never been at peace with all of the land occupied at one time that God said, yeah, you can have all that. So, which is fascinating. So if your God at the beginning of Genesis chapter 12 promises you land, seed, and blessing, and then outlines the dimensions of the land, there does it again here, is going to talk about it again in Deuteronomy for like two chapters. This is the geographical boundaries of the land. The land becomes a really big deal, right? And you feel a God-given, ordained right to that land, okay? So when we talk about, even today, if you're reading the news at all, Kerry is trying to mediate peace between the Palestinians and the Jews, and the land issue is one of the big things. Is who has the right to live in the land, and why are these Palestinian settlements, here, and why does Israel want them gone? Well, they believe that their God has given them the land, and indeed he has. So the Palestinians won't even recognize a Jewish state. They won't recognize the Jews as having right occupancy into the land. So as soon as they give way to any of their desires, the Palestinians continue to push and try to get Israel out, and it's just never been a good situation.
In the tabernacle, when they went to do sacrifices and stuff, would they hear the word of God?
Audibly, I don't know. Moses apparently did.
How do the people know all of the stuff?
They would read it. Somebody would read it. It would be recorded later on. And the priest, part of their job would be to recite it and know it and to read it and bring it out. And
at this time, they're not necessarily hearing it?
Yeah, not yet. So it hasn't been recorded yet. So, yeah, not for them at this point. So we'll see that later. Moses is going to write the first pieces of Scripture, which we're still reading. It hadn't been written yet. So, okay. So anyway, so just keep in mind, this is, the land's a big deal, okay? It's a major part of this covenant and insignificant, okay? So 34 is all about the boundaries of the land. 35, this is the Levitical inheritance, okay? So we get the inheritance for each one of the tribes mentioned in 34. The Levites are left out, okay? And we'll get into more of the allotment of the land, and I'll show you that in charts later, as soon as we get our handy-dandy TV. In 48, the Levites get Levitical cities, okay? In fact, they get 48 cities, 42 that are basically like salt and just scattered throughout the land, everywhere throughout the land. And then in verse 9 and following, God says, I want you to create six more cities. Actually, look at verse 6. This is where he talks about these. These cities you shall give to the Levites shall be six cities of refuge, which you shall give to the manslayer to flee to. In addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. So there are 42 regular cities that the Levites can go live in. Okay, so if you're a Levite, you can live in any of these. Okay, you have to live in one of them, but any of these are fine. And then there's six more on top of the 42. They're called cities of refuge. And they're described as cities for the manslayer to flee to. And in 35:15, these cities shall be a refuge for the sons of Israel, for the alien and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally shall flee there. Okay, so this is the purpose of these cities, is to have basically a safe haven. If you accidentally kill somebody, this is house arrest. Okay, but in a bigger, proximity, if you will. Okay. And you are free from being avenged of that crime by the family member of whom you took their son or their daughter or brother or whatever until verse 28. Pick up 26, 27, 28, and we'll kind of read the whole deal. 35, 26 through 28.
Manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of the city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of the city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, for he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest.
So you're safe as long as you're inside the city. If you leave that city, all right, if I kill Pete's brother and I'm in that city, and I decide I want to go for a walk outside the city and Pete finds me, he can kill me on the spot, okay, because I killed his brother. Now, if I'm inside the city, Pete can't touch me, okay, until something happens, end of verse 28.
But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall or may return to the land of his possession.
Okay, it's more of a not may, but shall, will, okay? So if the high priest dies, at this time Eleazar, game's off. You got to go back home. Okay, so it's not forever. It's just until the high priest dies. Okay, so it's kind of an odd law. The idea being, in a society where if you killed somebody, you had the right to take that person's life as an act of justice, God is giving that person a bit of grace for those that did it unintentionally. Okay, or you would have this vendetta mentality continuing. So I kill Pete's brother on accident. Pete kills me. One of my family members says, well, Pete killed Mike. Now we're going to kill Pete. And then, right, it can just spiral out of control. So this is part of the, to keep that from happening and to allow the person who did it accidentally. This is second degree murder. Okay, first degree murder, God says, literally, if that guy's worshiping at the altar, remove him from the altar and kill him. Like, it's that big a deal. You don't get a get out of jail free card. Okay, so those are the cities of refuge. Three on each side of the Jordan. Okay, not that you necessarily need to know them all, but I will mention a couple that will be important later in the story. One is Shechem or Shechem, okay? So that's in the middle of the land of Israel on the west side, and south of that is Hebron, okay? So just keep those two in mind. They're going to come up later. Those can be very important cities in our journey throughout the Old Testament, okay? So Shechem and Hebron are two that are going to be really, really important, okay? So that's chapter 35. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yep. So they are special Levite cities, if you will. But Levites would have lived there, along with obviously the people whoever's land that was in, right? So if you're in Hebron and that's Judah's land, then people from Judah living there, as well as Israelites, okay? So the idea, or Levites. The idea would be there are Levites in every tribe in 42, 48 cities across Israel. So the Levites are everywhere. Okay, so again, you get the picture of what God wanted for his people.
You said the cities of refuge are for people who it wasn't an intentional murder?
Correct.
Okay.
When you say that the cities are Levitical, does that mean they're the ones who get taxes?
They were just confined to live in those 48 cities. So
they get the land?
They're renting it from whoever's tribe is there. So they, so they have permission to stay, but it's not their land. Does that make sense?
What's the high priest that can go back to their city? Can they be killed now?
Game on. Yep. So.
Do you think they ever, anyone got so mad that they went after the high priest to try and kill him?
I'm going to kill you so that I can kill it. I think they just kind of skipped them. Man. Let TJ sleep with one eye open. Gracious, Layla. I'll call him right now. Buddy, look out. No, I don't think that. However, there are people that said, the heck with God's laws. I don't care what city you're in. I'm going to kill you anyway. And we're going to see that later on where someone had. We don't see the language used, but we see this person flee to this city. And all of a sudden, these two people are having a conversation. And then all of a sudden, this guy has a knife in his belly. And you're like, whoa, 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 what just happened? So with your astute eyes, you'll recognize what the text doesn't tell us, but it's assumed in a Jewish culture. Oh my gosh, this guy's like, he's on base. You can't kill a guy on base, and he just gets killed right there, right? So
they didn't have to, like, take out the high priest before. They just
I think that would have caused more problems than less, but no, not so much. Yeah, right.
There's 6 cities of refuge.
Senor, hello. This is Brad Bell. Have you guys met him?
Boker Tov. Good to see you all this morning. You'll learn that here shortly. Boker Tov means good morning in Hebrew. By the way, I checked the empty tomb this last week. Don't worry, he wasn't there. So every time I go, I think it's a good thing to check. And just a reminder, as we're getting closer to Israel, a couple thoughts. He's probably told you, you need to be hiking a little bit. Because even just going this last time, I thought, ooh, forgot about how hard the climbs were. The other is this. The trip, we really need a critical mass of 30. And we're talking about announcing it and whatnot, but truthfully, the best way to get people there is for you to invite people. So I don't know about you, but I really want to go. And I think you do too. And if that's the case, then let's get the word out, begin to invite some people so that we can make sure we got a critical mass to go. So just a heads up on that.
Yeah, good word. It's always tight every year, so we're at 16 with our crew, and we need to be minimum 30 and ideally 48. So unless you want to see Brad teach every site, which would be fun. So, but yeah, not so much fun for you guys, not fun for him. So, he'll be double rubbing early if you do that. So cool.
So sorry to interrupt.
No worries, dude. Thanks for coming in. So you're up early.
Where are you guys at right now?
We're about to do the Shema here in a little bit. So maybe we'll holler at you. Come. We're right at the end of Numbers. Yeah. So you guys are going to memorize the Shema in Hebrew. So, fun stuff.
We have such a deal.
Oh, absolutely. No problem. Cool.
All right. You guys enjoy.
Good to see you, buddy. All right. So, Raven, what were we asking tonight? Did I finish your question?
My question was, so there's 6 days of refuge in the text. Is it that common to have second degree manslaughter?
It seems common enough that they wrote about it in the law, like, you know, if your ox kills a person, like, that was considered second-degree murder. So it happened enough where in a society this large, yeah, like, accidents happen. So it seems like it. We don't see a ton of those stories in the text, but enough to where God covers it in the law just to make sure that, you know, if it happens, then here's what you do. So
this might be asking too much, but did they have to go and, like, check in somewhere? Like, hey, this happened, I'm protected here. Did they just
kind of,
like, sneak in the probation?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. I would assume it was known. Like, why are you relocating cities? Your family is all back there. It's like, well, my ox ran over this dude, and it's kind of my fault, so here I am. So, yeah, because you'd have to find a place to live. So I would assume it's not some secret deal because you don't have family there. More than likely, you've got to relocate. And so, yeah.
And you can't take your family?
Yeah, I suppose you could, but... You know, it's a mandatory relocation. So, you know, but if you've got land and, you know, families would continue just to build onto one home. So you've got not just your family, but now grandfathers and all this stuff that live in a big insula community together. It's a different deal to move your whole family. So maybe not.
What about if you already lived in a city of refuge? Would you have to go to another one?
It doesn't say. No, I think you're safe. So convenient. So kill anybody you want, accidentally. Whoops, sorry. Yeah, right? It was an accident. My bad. You can prove nothing. All right.
Mike, is that why you moved to Fresno?
That's right. It is a city of refuge. West side of the Mississippi. I am safe. So, Yeah, and as long as Brad's alive, I'm good. When he dies, it's all over. So...
Yeah. Yeah. He is the high priest. What's that? She probably will. That's why she's asking these questions. So if I kill Brad, then I can kill you. I'll bow our eyes and pray. All right, so there's 35. 36 we already covered. This is the Cali question from last week with the inheritance of women. What happens if the daughters of Zelophehad, who were promised their dad's land because he had no sons, what if they marry outside the tribe? And God went, okay, perfect. Yep, so marry your own kinfolk, and we're good, okay? So there's Numbers, okay? You guys got it. We're finished. Woo! Okay? So we started dividing the land. We got three tribes that have now settled on the outside of the Jordan, Transjordan, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And now we're going to get into Deuteronomy, okay? Deuteronomy, the entire book, for the most part, is review, okay? This is Exodus and Leviticus to the new generation, okay? Y'all weren't alive when we gave you these, you know, laws, or you were 2 years old sucking on your thumb, and you don't remember this anyway. So we're going to give you all this stuff so that you know that it's yours, and not just the generation that died previous to you, your parents, okay? So if you think of a word for Deuteronomy, review, okay? Turn real quick to 9:7, and this is kind of a sub-theme or even a theme of the book of Deuteronomy, okay? 9:7, if I were to give you a verse, here it is. In fact, Rachel, read that. This should bring good memories to you.
Just 9:7?
Just 9:7.
Remember, do not forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. From the day that you left the land of Egypt until you arrived at this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord.
All right, so you see this theme, and it's negative here, but there's this continual call in Deuteronomy to remember, don't forget. Remember, don't forget, okay? That word in Hebrew is zakor.
It's kind of hard for us to say. That's the best transliteration we have, Z-K-O-R. It's the word remember. Okay, we see different variations of it. You see it in chapter, where is it? Chapter 8, I think, for one of the first times, 8:2. You shall remember the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might fight for you, testing you. It's used 15 times in the book of Deuteronomy, just to remind the people, don't forget what God has done. Okay, this idea of remember is used 52 times in the Psalms. So when David is worshiping, he's actively remembering God's faithfulness and his past and Israel's past so that he will remember that God's going to be faithful in his future as well. Okay, so this is one of the bigger mantras, if you will, of the Israelites and especially of God when he's trying to tell them, remember your disobedience, remember how that went down, remember how I provided for you, and we're going to see all kinds of examples of that. But he's calling the people to not forget God in the middle of all their life, okay? So that's the idea, okay? When we went to Israel last year, that was kind of the theme verse for us, the theme of the trip was this idea of remember, don't forget, okay? Don't forget what God has done for you and for us, okay? So a quick one way to break down Deuteronomy, okay? 1-3 is going to be a rehearsal, the past, a rehearsal of Israel's past, a reminder of what they have done. So 1-3 is past. It's stuff that they've already done. It's the journeys reviewed. It's the Sihon and Og battles talked about again. We're going to see what they have done thus far. 4-11 is now, okay? It's here's what's going on. Here's what you need to do to obey. Here are the keys to victory as you enter the land. It's their present, okay, and what they need to do now. 12-30 is the law, okay? It's Leviticus and Exodus review, okay? The Mosaic law given again. So 1-3 past, 4-11 present. 12-30 is the second giving of the law. That's what Deuteronomy means, duat nomos, second law, okay? And then 31-34 is future. It's prophecy. It's Moses' last words, okay? So really, it's broken up into past, present, and future with 12-30, the law kind of sandwiched in between there, okay? 31-34, that's the end of the book, is prophecy or future, okay? We're going to see kind of Moses' swan song before God takes him, right? Because we know he's going to die before Joshua because he doesn't get to go into the land. God doesn't forget that. He's still going to make him do that. And then they're going to enter in afterwards, okay? So So let's look quickly at this. We're going to boogie through Deuteronomy because y'all have already read this before. You didn't die through our journey, so you don't need to remember all this again, okay? But there's some good things in here that are subtle nuances, a couple things that maybe weren't included in the original promises from God to Moses and then ultimately to the people, okay? But you'll notice just kind of some markers in here. Deuteronomy 1:2. It's an 11-day journey from Horeb, which is Mount Sinai, by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Came about in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel, saying, great, it's time to go. We're going to cross the Jordan. Okay, so they've been there 40 years. They should have made this journey in 11 days, which is crazy to think about. From Egypt up into the Promised Land, if you did that quickly, that's an 11-day journey, okay, by foot. But he says it took you 40 years. So it wasn't that you didn't know where you're going. It wasn't that you were lost. It was that God was trying to get Egypt out of you for 40 years. It was easy, and we're going to hear this in Israel often, easy to get the people out of Egypt, but getting Egypt out of the people was a whole nother battle, okay? And one that 40 years later still didn't happen, okay? So the desert experience for them was a refining, winnowing, difficult experience to try to remove all of their crutches that they leaned on that were wrong and unhelpful and get them to lean fully on God. And even at the end of that 40 years, those tendencies that are in them are still there, okay? Verse 8, see that I have placed the land before you. Go in and possess the land which your Lord, which the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their descendants. So here it is. Go take it, okay? And again, much of this is review of all the things that had happened. Verse 19 and following, you see the story of the spies that were sent out again, the report in 25 and following that they brought up, the bad report, all the giants that were in the land, but we see Caleb and Joshua, the son of Nun, step up, so all that again is reviewed. Chapter 2 is now about Sihon and Og. It's about them journeying through the lands of Esau, Edom, and Moab, so on and so forth. God does mention a couple tidbits for us that are really helpful regarding the people that are currently in the land. And I just want you guys to notice this, okay? Look at chapter 2, verse 8 and 9. Read that.
So we went on away from our brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir, away from the Araba road from Elos and Ezion Geber. Yeah.
Yep. All right, so we remember those stories that they had to go around those areas. Those were their lands. And he said, don't harass Moab. It's theirs because I've given it to Ar, the sons of Lot, their possession. In verse 10, he mentions the Enum or Emim lived there formerly. So before Moab got control of the land that God gave them, the Emim were there, a people people as a great numerous as tall as the Anakim. Who are the Anakim? You guys remember hearing about them? They're giants. Okay, so God's saying before Moab lived in the land that I gave them, giants lived in that land. So how did Moab get their land? What do they have to go do to get it? Fight against giants. And they're a pagan people that I really don't even care about. But because I gave them that land, I also gave them the ability to defeat the people that were in it. Okay, see also verse 12. The Hornites formerly lived in Seir, but the sons of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, just as Israel did in the land of their possession, which they gave them. Okay, verse 19, when you come opposite of the sons of Amnon, do not harass nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land that they had. Okay, verse 20, okay, the Rephaim lived in that land before them, and the Lord utterly, 21, destroyed them before them, and they possessed them and settled in their place. So the idea is there are all these pagan peoples that I'm not going to give you their land that live in these areas currently. Before they lived there, giants lived there. They had the tenacity and the chutzpah to go in to conquer these giants and go live in their land. So why is God telling Israel that? Absolutely. Like, if they can do it, you can do it. I really don't even care about them. You are my people, my special treasure. If they can do it, surely you can do it. So it's kind of a, it's kind of a backhanded slap and ends up being to Israel because they freak out and get nervous and won't be faithful. But like, listen, you beat Sihon, you beat Og. There's more coming, okay? These people are bigger, they're stronger, they're mightier, they have better technology, but don't wig out. I'm going to be faithful. That's what God's telling them, okay? So a couple stories in there that are just of significance, okay? Rest of chapter 2, 24 and following is about the Transjordan campaigns and those sorts of things. And all the way through 3, same deal. The allotment of the land given on the east side of the Jordan, okay? So that gets us to chapter 4. All that was review, okay? Now, here are the battle plans. This is fascinating, okay? Chapter 4, verse 1. If you're God and your people are getting ready to go to battle, think about what type of speech you would be giving them. This is the speech that God gives them, okay? 4:1, pick up there.
And now, Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you, and do them, that you may live and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you.
Okay, so here's the key to victory. Ready? You're going to go to battle. Here's what you need to do to go win the battle.
You shall not add to the word that I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you.
So what's the key to victory in a battle? Obey God. Like, wait a second. What about some battle strategy? What about how do we wield the sword? What about, like, what does our formation need to look like? What does God say? Obey me. Like, that doesn't make any sense, right? This is the pregame speech, and the coach is saying, read your Bibles. That's how we're going to win the Super Bowl. Like, that doesn't make any sense. But to God, it does, okay? That is the key to victory, obedience. God says, you obey me, you will win the battles. I'm not giving you a strategy. I'm not giving you any of that, okay? I'll be with you when you go in, but the key to all of this is obedience, okay? So for Israel, the key to victory is obedience, and that is where they're going to get sideways, okay? It seems like a very odd locker room talk for God, but it's exactly right, okay? He reminds them even in verse 3 and following, your eyes have seen what the Lord has done in the case of Baal Peor. You guys remember that story where 24,000 people died? He said that they lost because they were disobedient. They followed after another god, and as a result, they died. That is what caused the defeat in that case, if you will, okay? And he reminds them, verse 7, of kind of who they are to him, who Israel is in God's eyes. Read that.
For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us? Whenever we call upon him.
How about that? What a great reminder. Like, what other nation has a God like me who is there at your beck and call, who loves you? That is the relationship that is unique to Israel that I have with you. Okay, so just a fascinating view from God of what they need to do. And the idea is cling tight to me, obey me, trust me, and I will win the battles for you. Okay. So he continues to remind them in, you know, like 15, watch out for yourselves that you not carry any form on the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb in the midst of the fire. Don't bring anything into the land. Verse 17, the likeness of any animal. Do not bring in anything that would cause you to stumble. Any idols of any sort, verse 424, for the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. God says this of himself, okay? So don't bring any idols into the land, anything that would cause you not to be obedient, leave those where they are, okay? So again, more review and so on and so forth, okay? Chapter 5, God's going to kind of point this covenant at this new generation, okay? Look at 5:1-3, read that. What is that? Where is Horeb? Mount Horeb, also called Mount Sinai. Okay, so who did he make the covenant with at Mount Sinai? Which generation? The first generation, the old generation. But God says, we made that generation, the Lord your God made a covenant with us at Horeb, meaning the new generation. What is God trying to tell them about the law? It still applies. And it's not an old covenant or an old... It's no longer valid. He says, no, he made that with us. verse 3, the Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all of us alive here today. That is ours to keep. It's ours to obey. We have the privilege of having that promise of God. So he's reminding them, don't forget, okay, just because you weren't there, this covenant was made with you as well. Okay, so that's chapter 5. And then in following, it's the Ten Commandments. It's more commands. All the rest of chapter 5 is about that. Okay, now, chapter 6, this is one of the most important books, chapters in the book of Deuteronomy, and one of the most important sections in all of Israel's history. Okay, you heard Shay this weekend talk about the idea of being an intentional blessing, and he picked kind of two scriptures, love God and love others. This is the love God portion. This is the summation of the law. So when the lawyers were testing Jesus in the New Testament, and they said, give us, you know, tell us which laws are most important. This is where Jesus went. Love God and love others. So Deuteronomy 6 and then Leviticus 19, 18 talks about loving others. Okay, so here's the love God portion. So 6, 1, we'll read a bit of this.
By keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life, and that your days may be long.
Okay, now notice verse 2. How many generations are we talking about here? You, your son, and your grandson. So what does that entail? He's talking about teaching and knowing the commandments. What is the call to the current generation? How is their godliness measured? By their third generation, by their grandkids. Paul talked about that with Timothy. You know, Paul felt confident in who he had become as a discipler when he said, Timothy, I see the faith and obedience of the people that you disciple. Like, I know I have done right when I see the generation after you obeying God. That is success. So he's calling the people to say, listen, you have to teach these things. You have to hand them down. It doesn't stop with you. And he reminds them of that. That's the danger of an old generation dying and a new generation coming up. If they don't know the law, then they're not going to know to know it, and they're not going to know to teach it. Okay, so it's not enough just to teach people the law. You have to teach them to obey and to teach it to them, right? So as we talk about success in residency isn't me communicating these things to you. It's what happens after that. In a sense, my legacy, if you will, is left in your hands and how you teach others. So if you're the people that you're discipling, that you're pouring into, if they're obedient, then that says something about how this generation operated, if you will. Does that make sense? So your legacy should be much bigger than just the people that you have in your little small group. It's the 30 years after that. What are those people doing that you've poured into? That is ultimate success and obedience. So he's reminding the people of that, okay? Verse 4 now, here is the Shema. Okay, Shema, the word Shema literally in Hebrew means to hear, okay? From the ear, to hear. So hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Okay, that was the cry, and today is the cry of every Jewish person, to love God first and foremost with all of your being, okay? And we will, I will upload those things to Dropbox, but I'll give you guys a audio version of the Shema in Hebrew and the words in Hebrew, and you guys are going to learn that. We're going to recite it multiple times as we're in Israel, but that is the ABCs of an Israelite. Everybody knows that. You say it when you wake up, you say it when you go to bed, and you say it several times throughout the day. This was something that was repeated and known by all.
I have a question with verse 4. Lord, our God, the Lord is one. I think I heard someone read that as a defense that the Trinity doesn't exist.
Yeah.
How would you...
It's the same idea of you two are one. Mm-hmm. Are you really one? No, you're two, but you're one. Does that make sense? Right. That's the idea. It's the Lord alone. It's not singulars in one. It's the idea of prominent and only. He is the high. He is the only one to be worshipped. It's the word ichad. I'm trying to remember the exact translation, but that's the idea. So it's unified. So is the Godhead one? Yes, they are all God, and they are together in that regard. But yet they are also three. Yeah.
Can you spell
Shema. Shema. Pronounce Shema in Texas. Okay, so there you go. All right. Now, that's the command. Love God with all of your being, with your heart, with your soul, and your, like, every aspect of who you are needs to love God. Okay, and then he's going to flesh this out a little bit more. Verse 6, these words which I am commanding to you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk about them when you sit by the house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. So when you sit, when you walk, when you lie down, and when you sleep, you are going to teach these things to your kids. What does that mean? Sit, walk, stand, kneel, rise up, lay down. When are you teaching your kids? All the time. This is your life, okay? Current generation, instruct the next generation and teach them all the time. Every time that you're with your kids, this is discipleship, okay? When you go to the grocery store, when you hit your finger, you know, with a hammer, these are all, like, everything that you do, you're teaching your kids something. Teach them, okay? So he is reminding them. By the way, whose job is it to teach the next generation? Moses? Joshua? No, it's the parents' job. Godliness and the discipleship of the next generation is put in the hands of the parents. So put that in a context now 2,000 years later, or from here, 3,000 years later. Whose job is it to raise up the next generation? Is it the church's job? No, it's the parents' job, okay? The church is a supplement, right? We are just coming alongside of what's supposed to already be happening in the home, right? If my home's a disaster, the church ain't going to fix that, right? My kids get Cali for, you know, an hour on Sunday, and apparently it's not that good anyway. So, tease them. She can't fix what I screw up, you know, 98% of the week, right? Nobody can do that. So if I'm not instructing my kids at home and they're not getting some sense of godliness in the home and all that goes with that, the church can't fix that. It's our job, okay? So as you guys think through your roles in instructing others, that was the privilege given to Israel, okay? Verse 8, here's where this is. People take this literally in Israel, which is kind of cool. Read that. 8 and 9, chapter 6.
You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes.
What is that? What does that mean in a Jewish context? Have you guys seen?
Phylacteries.
Yeah, the phylacteries. That they would literally, there's a wooden box with a strap on it that they would tie to their foreheads. And you'll see people today, when we go to Israel, with a box with scripture tucked in it. What scripture do you think they have tucked in their box? This one, right? You're going to bind those things on your forehead. Now, I think the imagery is ram those things in your brain, right? Remember God, don't forget. So they were like, oh, great. Then we're going to tie a box to our forehead so that we remember, don't forget God, okay? So you see these phylacteries, this is what they call them, that they would tie onto their foreheads if you were a biblical Jew, if you will, okay? You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You'll see them wrap a leather strap around their hands, and that was a symbolic of how they memorized scripture. Verse 9, you shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. You will see in every hotel that we go in, on your door there is a mezuzah, which is the law of God written on their doorpost. They do this. Houses that you go in for Torah-believing Jews, that is what they put on there when you walk in, right? This is their, as for me and my house, we shall obey the Lord, their cry from Joshua. This is it for them, okay? They write it everywhere, okay? So pretty cool, all right? Now, here's the fascinating part. God tells them all this because of verse 10. This is why you have to do this, okay? Look at verse 10 and following. So what's about to occur in the lives of the Jews, the Hebrews? They're about to get blessed, right? Do you think they forgot God in the wilderness? No, because they're worried about what in the wilderness? Am I going to eat tomorrow? Is there going to be water? Do we have shelter? Are we going to die? What happens when you walk into a land like this? Are your needs met? Do I need a shepherd? No. Like, I walk outside and there's food everywhere. There's water everywhere. There's abundance everywhere. There's wells that I didn't dig. There's cisterns that I didn't have to put in the ground that hold water. There's fruit and whatever that I... Everything I need is provided. Why do I need God, right? It's the greatest obstacle to the gospel in our culture. Why do I need God? I have everything I need. I got 2.5 kids, a white picket fence, can pay my mortgage. I'm successful. Why do I need your God, right? That's the issue. And God tells them that you're going to have plenty. Anybody can deal with nothing. Plenty, however, is the problem. Success is difficult, and it's easy to forget God, right? When you're at the end of your rope and just taking a beating, everybody clings to God, right? It's at the other end of the spectrum when you have everything. That's the test of faith. I've heard it said numerous times that anybody can handle poverty. Very few people can handle success because it tests your gut and your innards saying, I did this. I did this for myself. God didn't do this for me. Why do I need God, right? So, and it's a very short-sighted and delusional way of thinking. And it's so easy to forget in the midst of plenty. And that's why a lot of us struggle, right? We can pay our bills. We're not going to drive a Maserati, but you know, bills can get paid and we're taken care of and we're going to eat tomorrow. We're not worried about the needs of today. They're going to get taken care of, okay? And that's what's difficult. And God tells them, this time is coming. Do not forget me when it comes, okay? So that's the idea. So he commands them to remember, okay? The rest of chapter 6 is all about that. Remember, don't forget. And that's God's highest command so that they don't do that, okay? Chapter 7 is more on when they get into the land, okay? So a couple things just to note in here. 7 verse 1, when your Lord God shall bring you to the land which you are going to possess, stay clear of the nations that are before you. And he mentions now 7 nations, okay? The Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. 7 nations greater and stronger than you, okay? You're going to go to battle with the big boys, and they are all bigger and stronger than you, okay? And when the Lord your God shall deliver them from before you, and you shall defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them, okay? They're all bigger. Don't worry about it. Obey me, and they will be taken care of, just like I did with Moab, just like I did with Edom. You're going to conquer those nations. Don't make a covenant with them, okay? Specifically, what type of covenant? Verse 3. Marriage. Do not intermarry with them. Do not offer your sons for their daughters and vice versa. We're not going to intermarry with pagans that don't believe in God. It's no bueno, okay? Because, verse 4.
For they will turn away your sons from following you to serve other gods.
So does God just not like other people groups? No. Why does he tell them, you may not intermarry with these people? Because they don't love me. And if they don't love me, then they're not okay. Okay, that's 1 Corinthians 7. That's being equally yoked. He says, my concern is your hearts will be led astray if you marry these other people. Okay, now if they want to come on board and worship me, game on. Okay, bring in Ruth, the Moabitess. Okay, got no problem with Rahab. I have no problem with those people that are from different areas and grew up worshiping pagan gods. If you want to bring some rabble from Egypt that want to acknowledge me as God, no problem. Okay, but that's not cool. Okay, so they're going to turn your hearts away. Verse 5, you shall do to them, you shall tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, hew down their asherim. You guys remember those poles that they would worship at? The Asherah, the female goddess, the mother of Baal, and like 70 other crazy weird gods. He says, cut them all down. Yeah, Layla.
Is this kind of the same thing that God was talking about in Numbers 33, where he's telling them when you go in to destroy all of the...
Yep.
To destroy all of it?
Absolutely.
So was he saying, like, not only destroy their idols, but was it to kill all of them too? So now it feels like it's lessening, where it's like, well, I told you to kill them, but now I'm telling you just don't marry them?
No, he's saying, don't be tempted to do anything in that regard. So tear down all of their stuff, drive them out of the land. And it wasn't necessary that they had to kill them all, but they had to conquer the whole land and remove the people. Like, if you want to go relocate to Oklahoma, great. But you're not staying in California, okay? So now they're going to go to battle because the people aren't just going to walk away. But if you want to export them, fine.
Is that purposeful, knowing that, I mean, in the beginning it was, like, incredibly harsh, but then now, because they'll Lord knows that they're not going to do that 100%, he's maybe making it more like specific to...
Yeah, I think to some degree you would probably wonder, like, okay, so we kill the men in battle. What do we do with the women and children? You know, do we intermarry with them? Like, no, don't even do that. So I think he's just being even more specific of knowing that there's a sense of wickedness in them, like us. You know, where's the loophole? What did God really mean? Right? No, no intermarriage. No, nothing. Get rid of them. Okay, that's the idea. Verse 7, this is kind of just another cool reminder in the midst of it, of who God is to them and how he thinks about Israel.
It was not because you are more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you are the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, the hand of the Pharaoh, king of Egypt.
This is a great reverse, and I think this applies. It's so true today. Why did God choose Israel? Because they were bigger? Because they were stronger? What is the motivating factor that this verse talks about, according to Moses, as to why God chose? Love. He loved you, and he didn't love you because you were more impressive. In fact, you were less. He didn't love you because you were stronger. In fact, you were weaker. He didn't love you for any external reason other than he loves you, okay? It's the idea, even here, of sovereign election. He chose you, and he drew you to himself, okay? God loves you, okay? And he just, again, reminds them of that, okay? So, chapter 7 is all about that, okay? God loves you. Keep his commandments. Continue to obey. That's the key to victory. You're going to walk into a land that has plenty. Do not forget God, okay? And he even promises in 15 and following, there's blessings that are going to come. And we're going to get into this even more so in Deuteronomy. He says, listen, if you'll obey me, I'm going to give you all these blessings. I'll bring the rains. I'll take care of your crops. Your storehouses are going to be full. You'll be in good shape. Just obey. However, if you don't obey me, there's like this list. It's three times as long of all the curses, if you will, that will happen. Okay. Chapter 8, more of the same. Okay. Keep obeying. There's a cool... just two and following, let's just read this in chapter 8, is to why God allowed them to go through what they went through for the last 40 years. 8, 2 and following, read that.
And you shall remember the whole way that the Lord your God has led you these 40 years in the wilderness, that he might humble you, test you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let your hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know.
Okay, stop right there for a second. This is cool. Remember what God did that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart. What are the purpose of trials? It's to bring out what's in, what's there. I'm testing you to find out, what are you made of? Are you going to lean on me when it gets ugly and it gets hard? Look at verse 3. This is cool. He humbled you and let you be hungry. God allowed you to be in a spot of difficulty for a purposeful thing. It wasn't an accident. He let you hunger so that you would trust him, right? All of this was divinely orchestrated, and he allowed it to be because he loves you, and he's testing you and wanting you to, he's running to refine you, if you will. So you ever thought about trials that way in your life? That God would let you be hungry? That he would let you not be able to pay the PG&E bill? Like, what a fascinating way to view difficulty in our lives, right? And in the midst of it, look at verse 4. Have you ever thought about this? Your clothing did not wear out. Your foot did not swell these 40 years, right? Your sandals lasted forever. I gave you a sweet pair of Birkenstocks, and they lasted 40 years. You had the change of clothes that you left Egypt with, and they lasted the entire time. How is that? It's a miracle, right? You didn't have some, you know, funky foot that was all swollen and nasty, and he provided for you and allowed you to go through this, but yet still protected you from even certain things. So, fascinating.
So, is it like so that we can see what's in our heart? Because God already knows. Is it just so we can get that?
Yeah. Because he knows our hearts are divided, right? So, he's trying to remove all the things from them that are... that distract us from worshiping God. And sometimes it takes environments like that to say, I'm going to remove everything. And at times, food, shelter, the most basic of provisions, what motivates you, right? And you see very quickly what motivates people. Like, if you guys have ever taken folks on mission trips in difficulty, and you take away just the basic needs, food, water, shelter, convenience, rest, like, what's in comes out. Like, some of my most difficult times I remember were being in Thailand with Brad in 1997, when all of a sudden we're in a jungle, and I got a bug, and I can't eat, and everything's coming up, and I'm like, oh God, I want to go back home to Pizza Hut and a bed and a toilet that flushes. Like, that is my, like, I would love to have those things. I will pay $100 right now for pepperoni pizza and to be out of this place, right? That's because that's what was in me. And God had to just beat me for a while to get that out of me. And that's what it took. And I needed it. But boy, it wasn't, I couldn't learn that lesson, right, in Denton, Texas and living in plenty. And I couldn't. He had to take me there to get that out of me. And the key for me is to not forget that, so I don't have to go through it again. So, but I probably will, because I'll probably forget. So, okay. Verse 8 and following, again, the reminder of don't forget. Beware in verse 11 that you do not forget the Lord your God. When you have eaten, verse 12, and satisfied, built good houses. Verse 13, we have herds and flocks, and they multiply in silver and gold. Don't, verse 14, let your heart become proud and forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Don't do it. He's begging them, because success is hard. So don't forget it. I allowed you to go through what you went through all these years. I'm about to bless your socks off. Please don't forget. You guys see the theme, by the way? Are you bored with it yet? Like, he's pounding this into their brains. Don't forget me. Because what's going to happen? They're going to forget him. And he tells Moses that, right? He pulls him up on the mountain later and whispers in his ear, by the way, these people are going to forget me. I'm going to have to kick them out of the land. I'm going to put them into exile. Babylon's going to come in and spank them. And then Assyria's going to come in and spank them. And I'm going to kick them out of the land. But I'm going to bring them back in, knowing all this is going to happen. God predicts the future and tells Moses, before I kill you, here's what's going to happen to these people. So he knows it's all going to occur, but he's begging them for it not to occur. Okay, so keep God first in your heart. And foremost, okay? So all this again, just remember, don't forget. Remember, don't forget, okay? Let's go to, turn real quick to chapter 17. Something else that's kind of fascinating, okay? We're just, again, this is all review of the law, okay? So don't, you know, if you guys want to browse through it on your own, please do. But you have seen all of this before, so don't panic that we haven't covered something that you wish you would have, okay? 14 of chapter 17, God gives a command that we haven't seen before. Read that. So what are they going to ask for? What does God tell them? When you get to the land, you're going to want one of these. A king. Why? Because everyone else has one. Who's Israel's king? God. You don't need a king. But God says, I know you're going to ask for one. So here's what you're going to do. Verse 15. Okay, so what does God say about a king? Can they have one?
Yes.
Yeah. Is it God's first desire? No, he'd prefer them not to have a king. But he knows they're going to want a king because they want to be like everyone else. So who does the king get to be according to verse 15? Okay. Who chooses the king? God. Who picked the first king of Israel? Samuel. Picked Saul. Why was Saul not the best king? His heart was wicked. How did they choose Saul, by the way? You guys remember any of those stories? Dude, he was Fabio, right? He's 6'4", he's got long flowing locks, he's tan, he's ripped, right? He's a model. He is a good looking, strong dude, right? And Saul actually starts off really well. We give him a lot of, we bag on him a little bit, but Saul's actually, comes from a great family, is a good kid, and he starts okay, but then what's in comes out, and we see him fail. And then God says, okay, good try, Israel. How about you let me choose the king, like I said in Deuteronomy 17, and I'm going to pick a guy that's incredibly unimpressive on the outside, is not anybody that would stand out in a crowd. He's a little shy boy that is a shepherder of sheep from Bethlehem. Who does God pick? David. And David is the ideal king in God's eyes, right? Redheaded kid with freckles, not impressive on the outside, but boy, the kid can write psalms. He worships God. He's got his issues, right, which we'll see, but he's a great king, okay? Just a few. Murder and adultery being at the top of the list, okay? So we'll see. But
God says, I'm going to let you have a king, okay? Verse 16 and following, look what else is the requirement of the king. Yes.
Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses.
Okay, so if you're a king, what else can't you have? A lot of what? Stuff, right? Your job is not to acquire a bunch of things. So 16, horses. Verse 17, what else? Well, come on in. Nice sweatshirt. I didn't know it was Twinkie Day. Sweet. Mischievous, not yet.
And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away.
Okay, what else can you not have a bunch of?
Wives.
Women. Okay, so you can't have a lot of wives. Now, this isn't talking about being a kinsman redeemer. This is talking about you can't have 900, right? Like some king did in Israel, okay? 18, what else can you not have? I'm sorry. The rest of 17. Excessive silver or gold. What does that mean? You're not going to be filthy rich. Okay, your job as a king is not so that you can have a bunch of horses, right? You can't have a garage full of Rolls Royce and Lamborghinis, right? Have nine homes, be filthy loaded, have wives to the full. That was not the job of the king, right? That's Solomon. That's what happened to him. And all those things led his heart astray. So God says, you can't have too much of any of those, right? One's ideal, you know. Some money in your bank account's fine, right? Have a few things, but not a ton. Verse 18 and following, what else should he be?
And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life.
What does that mean? What should the king have? A Bible. And what else should he do with it?
Read it.
And how about obey it, right? That's my king, and that's what David was, and that's what we're going to see, okay? So note the self. God sees the king coming. He predicts him. He says, great, that's not my first desire. It's not evil. Do it this way when you do it, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So there's 17. So make note of that. You're going to see that later, okay? There you are, okay? Again, more review of all this stuff. Let's go all the way to chapter 27. A couple things, all right? When they go into the land, they're going to get commanded when they go to the town of Shechem, to basically utter all these things that God's given them on two different mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And literally, they're going to stand one group on the top of one mountain, the other group on the other side of the mountain, and they're going to shout out the blessings of the law and the curses of the law. Do this and we'll prosper, and don't do this or we're going to die, right? And they're going to shout back and forth at each other, and we're going to see Joshua, when he goes into the land, he's going to do this, okay? Based on 27, 12, and 13, when you cross the Jordan, stand on Mount Gerizim and bless the people, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin, and for the curse shall stand on Mount Ebal, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and right? It's like, here's the scripture, go read it publicly, y'all read the blessings, y'all read the curses, tell each other what's going to happen. That's what he commands. So it's an odd kind of way to flesh it out, but God wants to have, like, you know, a public reading and declaration of what he has promised, okay? Now, in 20, yes, ma'am.
Would the mountains be close enough for them to hear each other?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, you'd have to shout pretty loud, but yeah, they were definitely in hearing distance of each other. We have not been there. Brad has been there. Shechem is Palestinian controlled, so to get into the town is really difficult, so we can't go. But Brad went a couple days earlier with a really, really small group a couple years ago and stood here, okay, and saw the mountains. It's like, oh, yeah, right, they're right there. So this isn't like Fresno and Clovis. This is, you know, a valley in between two mountains, and you could shout across and hear each other. So kind of a cool picture, okay? So 28 and following, this is the, you guys remember the different types of covenants that we talked about? The Abrahamic covenant, what type of covenant was that? You guys remember? Unilateral. It's a one-way covenant, okay? This covenant with the law is a suzerain vassal, or a two-way treaty. It's an if you, then I, okay? This is the formal kind of covenant where God's going to say, these are the promises that I'm going to do for you if you obey. This is what's coming in the cursings if you don't obey. So their job was to obey or to disobey, and God's job was to do what he was going to do. In 28 and all the way through 30 is really the all the blessings and the cursings that would come from the law. So God is promising them what ultimately will happen. If they obey, they're going to live fine. They're going to have all that they need, and God will provide for them. If they disobey, it's going to be difficult. Okay? Look way down at chapter 28, verse 36, and look what God predicts here. This is part of the cursings of the law.
The Lord will bring you and your kings whom he has set over you to the nation that neither you nor your father have known. And there shall we serve there, and there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone. And you shall become a horror and a proverb and a byword among all the people, and the Lord will lead you away.
What does that sound like when the people of Israel with their king get kicked out of the land and have to go to another land where they worship other gods and become a laughingstock to all the nations around them? It's the exile. That's Babylon. That's Assyria. God promises them, listen, if you do this, I will kick you out of the land because I love the land too, and I will not allow you to do in the land what the people before you did in the land, i.e., Leviticus 18, and all the laws that God said, don't do these things, by the way, because the Canaanites have been doing them, and they're filthy and McNasty and want to make us throw up in our mouth. He said, don't do them. And if you do them, you're gone. I love you too much to allow that to happen. I'm going to do it. And by the way, he tells Moses, you're gonna, so I'm going to kick you out. Okay? Look at verse 64 of chapter 28. Moreover, the Lord will scatter you among the peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. There you shall serve other gods of wood, stone, of which your fathers have not known. You're going to go worship new gods, creative gods, different gods, because I'm going to throw you out of the land and scatter you everywhere. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay, 29, same stuff. This is the 29 and 30 are what is referred to as the Palestinian covenant or the land of Palestine, the land portion of the Abrahamic covenant. I'll walk you guys through that kind of in more detail later on. But just so you guys can kind of hang a hat on it and know what it is. This is more about the land and what's gonna happen. So again, he's commanding them to stay faithful, not to back out of their commitment and their covenant with God, and a promising of the exile that will happen. Okay. Now, not only does God promise to kick them out of the land, he also promises one day to bring them back into land. So they're gonna go in, God's gonna throw them out, and he says, but in time, I will bring them back in. Okay. Last verses of chapter 29, this is the piece where they get thrown out again, okay? Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the land to those to whom he brought every curse which is written in the book. Verse 28, the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and in fury and in great wrath and cast them into another land as it is to this day, okay? Chapter 30, he promises, I'm going to bring them back. So he's telling this to the people and to Moses, okay? Now, this is fascinating. Chapter 30, verse 1, let's just quickly read a couple of these verses, and then there's a guy in the Old Testament that quotes this back to God later on. Read 31 and following.
And when all these things come upon you, the blessings and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you today, with all your heart and with all your soul. Then the Lord your God will restore your fortunes and have mercy on you. And he will gather you again from all the people where the Lord your God has scattered you.
So he's telling them this now. Listen, when you get your minds right and get out of your funk, and one day we're in another land where I've scattered you, if you'll obey me, remember this book, and do what I've asked, which is obey me, then what am I going to do in verse 30 and verse 3? I will restore you from captivity. I will bring you back into the land. Verse 4, even if you're outcast on the ends of the earth, I will gather you. I will bring you back. Verse 5, the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed. You're going to possess it. I will multiply you. I will circumcise your hearts. I will put the law of God in your heart. I will make you to walk with me. So he promises even then, right? I haven't even brought you into the land yet. I'm going to bring you in, I'm going to kick you out, but I'm going to bring you in again. There's a guy that finds this, reads it, quotes it back to God and says, God, do it. Who is that guy? Not Jeremiah. Not Ezra. Close. Nehemiah. In Nehemiah 1, Nehemiah is in captivity in Persia. He's been kicked out of the land with the rest of his forefathers. He's reading his Bible and quotes Deuteronomy 30 back to God and says, God, you promised to bring us back. I'm repenting of our sins, me and my people. We've done this. You were just in kicking us out. Please bring us back. And what does God do?
okay, how about you lead it? How about you go back and you go rebuild the wall around Jerusalem? Let's reestablish this city. Let's get Ezra. Let's get Zerubbabel. Let's rebuild the people. Let's rebuild the temple. Let's go back and let's worship God once for all. Okay, so that's coming. All right, so God calls the shot there far before that even ever happens. Okay, so we'll pick up tomorrow in chapter 30, see the end of Deuteronomy and start in Joshua. Okay, let's do this tomorrow. Let's set up shop next door. Okay. I need the projector and screen, so just tomorrow as we come in, let's go in Ada and set up over there so I can try to get you guys some visuals that we're going to need for our journey into the book of Joshua. All right? Cool?